Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Today's episode is sponsored by Framebridge. They provide the easiest way to custom frame your favorite art and photos without ever leaving your house. Here's how to get started. Go to framebridge.com and use promo code VICE. You'll save an additional 15% off your first order. Welcome to the VICE Magazine podcast, your definitive monthly guide to enlightening information. August marks the release of our 16th annual photo issue called The Idols Issue. We paired 16 up-and-coming photographers with the veterans that inspired them to pursue the medium, creating unique photographic conversations between generations of talents. So, throughout today's episode, you'll hear from some of the young photographers in the issue on the artists who inspire them. Here's the table of contents. Photo editor Elizabeth Renstrom describes our dual covers and why we chose Idols as our theme.
Even as it searches for novelty, photography is fundamentally additive. It's a process of building a tradition and a language, one that owes as much to what came before as it depends on what is still to come.
Logan Jackson talks to his idol, Roe Etheridge, about the beauty of getting it exactly wrong in photography.
You know, maybe that's part of this conversation, is that it's getting to the place where it's like, I don't have to justify photography.
Olivia B. talks to her idol, Doug Dubois, about how their images help them process their own lives.
I never had a diary. I never used my camera to sort of really make pictures of things happening.
Here's Tommy Kaw explaining why he chose William Eggleston as his idol.
"You're looking too fast," Bill Eggleston says as I turn to the next page of his book. We don't talk much about photographic theories when I'm over at his place. I figured he gets asked those questions a lot. Instead, we talk about Takeout, the movie he has on, family, and then he plays the piano. On the surface, our work is very much opposite of each other, but it has to do with the everyday and the accessible, like hunting and gathering.
Our photo issue focuses on young, up-and-coming photographers and the idols or mentors that had a crucial impact on them, sometimes directly impacting their own work, whether they realize it or not. Photo editor Elizabeth Renstrom recalls one such mentor in this month's Behind the Cover.
Even as it searches for novelty, photography is fundamentally additive. It's a process of building a tradition and a language, one that owes as much to what came before as it depends on what is still to come. At a moment when billions of photos are made every day, people tend to forget about the before, especially in reference to new work. Connecting your work to that of the past is so important. It adds complexity. With that in mind, for our annual photo issue, we reached out to 16 up-and-coming photographers and asked which photographer inspired them to pursue the medium. Then we approached their idols to see if they would be willing to publish work in the issue as well. What was provided, I think, creates a unique conversation about the line of influence between younger and older artists. It also stays true to our commitment of bringing up young talent while honoring masters in the field. Some of the pairings, like our cover stars Tommy Kaw and William Eggleston, both born in Memphis but separated by several generations, are more directly linked stylistically. With others like Tasneem Al-Sultan and Maggie Stebber, you may have to give a second look to see the lines drawn between their work. Taken together, these photographic conversations reveal the liveliness and vitality of the discipline. They forge aesthetic connections and deepen artistic understanding, much like those first conversations I had with my idol. Tommy Kaw, the photographer behind the vibrant blue Elvis impersonator cover, is a photographer based between Brooklyn and Memphis. He received his MFA from Yale University in 2013. His work has been exhibited around the country and internationally, including in Germany, China, and Canada. Ka occasionally acts, most recently appearing in Laurie Simmons' film, My Art. Ka describes his work as being about the self in self-portrait, the portrait in self-portrait, and the hyphen in self-portrait. His idol for the 2017 photo issue, William Eggleston, is considered one of the pioneers of color photography and the creator of our vibrant red cover in a diner. His work emphasizes the interesting and beautiful complexities of the mundane world and the American vernacular. From gas stations to a diner's vacant parking lot, Eggleston finds the vibrancy in ordinary life. Eggleston has received countless awards, including the Getty Images Lifetime Achievement Award. His work has been exhibited in the biggest museums all over the world, including the Getty Museum, the Whitney Museum of American Art, the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, and San Francisco Museum of Art, just to name a few.
Here's Tasneem El-Sultan explaining why she chose Maggie Stieber as her idol.
Photography is a beautiful craft. You become a storyteller, a navigator, and most importantly for me, a romantic. I can tell who you are and what you're feeling from the images you've captured. From Maggie Stieber, I can tell she's graceful, a very graceful human being. I can tell that she falls in love with the people that she photographs, each and every time. She gives them a sense of pride and beauty to just be themselves. It's never about her wit and humor, which she most definitely has, or about her experience in life. It's always about the people in front of her. She's one of the most hardworking and determined photographers that continues to bring new and important work to the world.
Two Southern transplants, Logan Jackson and Roe Etheridge, talk about recontextualizing editorial work into art.
My first question was just like, where did you grow up? Like, where are you from?
I was born in Miami.
Yeah.
And then we moved to Atlanta when I was about 10.
Well, one of my questions was, have you ever been to Arkansas? What do you think of the South? But since you're sort of from the South, you might have more to speak on that than I thought.
Growing up there, there was some urgency to deny the influence of it, at least as like something authentic, you know?
Yeah.
And being like a suburban person, it was more, you know, especially in Atlanta, you know, it's like more, you know, sort of addressing in, you know, sort of like fascinated and also like negative way, the generic, you know, middle class conservative suburban thing, you know, as like both like as like a blessing and a curse, I guess. And, you know, it was that funny thing of like, you know, I grew up around photography because my dad was interested in it when I was a kid. But, you know, once it came time to make a decision about what to do with one's life, you know, their advice was, you know, like art and photography, and you know, that's fine as a hobby, but you know, you need a profession or something, you know, like a business degree or something. So it wasn't like it was encouraged. Creativity was something to, you know, dabble in, not to pursue as a career.
Say like you're shooting something for an assignment, like for a fashion client or just and some kind of commercial client. Are you thinking while you're shooting these, like how you could recontextualize them like down the line, or does that kind of thing sort itself out when you are finished and like when the down the line time comes?
It's never the same, you know, there's always a different thing, but it does happen often that like, it's best to not know the answer to that question because, you know, it's, that's what's interesting, you know, it's just like discovery and not being, you know, not having a sort of theoretical practice, you know, it could be something that's so particular that it can't really be anything other than that advertisement or that editorial.
That's like one of the most interesting things. What do you think about the notion of there being like a bad photograph?
For a long time, I've referred to this Warhol quote about getting it. He said, "I want to get it exactly wrong."
Yeah.
And
I always thought that was just like so amazing, you know, just like, that's right, you know, and I sort of have, I suppose I'm of two minds on that, and because on one level I was always fascinated with how to make something. You know, when I went to art school, it was like there was no technical teaching of like how to make a perfect image. You know, it was talk therapy. You know, it was like,
yeah.
For me, I was much more interested in the conceptual because, as I said earlier, I was rebelling against what seemed like a sort of lame emotionality in like what was supposedly Southern photography or something like that. I mean, I guess I just recently had a survey show, which is curated and organized, so there's purpose to the selection.
Right.
But looking back at it, it's really quite, it almost seems like, you know, it's just a very slow conceptual art project, you know?
Yeah.
It was like it took 20 years to put all these pictures together, in a way, because they seemed to all go together, you know, and it was like, oh, okay. Yeah, I see. You know, there's these themes that run through it and compositional motifs and color, and there's a voice. You know, maybe that's part of this conversation, is that it's like it's getting to the place where it's like, I don't have to justify photography. You know,
right.
It's like it is polyphonous. It is like multiple. It is like, and everybody's a fucking photographer. Instagram is, you know, I mean, I find myself wandering through people's, you know, Instagram feeds and seeing stuff that's like, wow, that's pretty good, or, you know, like I see that person's style, you know, I see that person's intent, you know,
and they're just iPhone photos like most of the time, which
but it's still like there's something, you know, it's an iPhone photo that's going to that same place, like the destination. The perspective and scale are set. You know, it's not supposed to go up on the wall. It's supposed to go in your phone. And so, like, you know, it cuts out a lot of the decision-making that we used to have to do, or just running around, you know, running to the lab to get film developed and get contact sheets and select one. It's like, I already, you know, in the time that it took you to do that, I've, like, you know, posted 5 pictures, you know, in a week, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's like people use their image making in the service of, you know, their promotion or their voice or their, like, you know, just like to document their life, you know, and all those things are all over the place. You know, all you have to do is look at 3 friends' Instagram and you see, you know, it's like the image has that mutability, can go and do all these different things, you know.
Right. Is there such a thing as bad photography?
We don't even think about it anymore because there's nothing, there's no shock to it. You know, we're also like experts at consuming. So like, you know, there's never a time where we're not trying to find that novel thing. And perhaps like in some ways, we don't even know what's really bad yet or anymore. Or something.
We have no idea.
Yeah. How do you make it bad if bad is good?
It's opinion based.
It's like signage at parties is bad photography, but it's like, I would actually say, like, I don't know, it's so bad, it's good, you know?
Right. And that is, I mean, that's something that I feel like I hear all the time. Like, and I say that all the time. Like, when I say that I like something because it's so bad that I think it's funny, like, I don't even mean to use the word bad in the way that it's associated usually. Like, you know, I could talk about this forever and ever, but I feel like I probably shouldn't.
Yeah. And I probably should get back to work here because I'm actually on a job right now in a kind of slow moment. You ask me a question and I'll try to answer it real quick.
Sure. Who is your favorite artist?
I don't know.
Okay. shit. Yeah, I knew that one was too much.
No,
okay.
It's, I mean, there's so many, you know, it's really
know,
an impossible
answer. That would take a long
time. I want to say John Curran, but that doesn't seem fair.
Would you direct a feature film?
No, but I would consider episodic television.
Here's Maria Gruzdeva explaining why she chose Mark Power as her idol.
When I first came across Mark Parr's work, I was completely amazed by his sense of place and the colors. He became my hero in photography. And I was lucky enough to be in a portfolio review with him when I was just beginning to work on my first project. And apart from being a great photographer, Mark Parr is also a great mentor. And he gave me some practical advice, but most importantly, he told me to carry on. And I'm so grateful for the motivation.
Olivia B. and Doug Dubois talk about the importance of honesty in photography, from how a picture is made to how it's used.
Do you use pictures to process your own life?
Oh, like, of course. Because,
okay, yeah, I would think so.
My guess is you do as well. Although I don't do it like you. I don't know exactly how you do it. So here's my assumption. I'm going to make guesses on how you work. I mean, totally guess. Total guess. This will be fun. I feel you, you work, although not exclusively, but probably earlier, and it's, I have a sense that it might be shifting. You worked a little bit, you know, kind of like a diarist. So the camera was a part of recording your life. You know, you could write, "Dear diary, today, blah, blah, blah. I got really stoned and it was beautiful and I watched the sunrise." Or you use your camera and you made pictures, or you do both. I don't know, right? Now, I never did that. I never had a diary, and I never made pictures. I never used my camera to sort of really make pictures of things happening. Not really. A little more earlier on than later, but then I realized I'm less interested in photographing things happening than photographing the idea of things happening. And making things happen. So that was a shift for me early on. I have a feeling you're shifting a wee bit that way. You're creating or recreating or inventing, purely inventing, as much maybe as you recorded before. I don't know. But that's my sense with your pictures.
Yeah, I think you're right, because I've started making more series that are based on, I guess, the pictures I take that are my diary. I kind of use those as notes for the series that I'm like creating, and like making it like a more pop, like narrative kind of world, rather than just like, I still photograph whatever happens around me because I like need it for myself. But as far as like art and fulfillment goes, I like to make them the notes to something bigger that I've been creating.
I'm not really adept anymore at photographing in the moment. I don't know that I can do it. I'm like, you know, I always forget that I always have a camera with me. I forget. That's sort of a generational thing. I didn't grow up having a camera in my pocket. But even when it's there and I kind of remember and things are happening, I'm relatively inept at capturing. Sometimes I'm getting the zone.
Is it because you want to be more of a witness to the moment, or like,
no, I think I think it's a kind of athletics. You know, it's like a muscle memory. It's a way of moving with your camera, with your eye, with your, you know, that I haven't practiced in so long. A because I've been working with big cameras and they're just, you just can't, you don't do it. That I'm so bad with this. I like, all my cameras are like, all my pictures are blurry for one, because I don't hold it steady. I forget to stop waving it around. And I never like them.
Like the more interpreted, the idea of the moment.
No, I like yours. I would love to be able to, I like yours. You know, I look at them and I go, God, I don't think I can make that picture anymore, you know? When I was, in my 20s, I was thinking of myself not as a journalist, because that, the whole idea that scared the hell out of me, but the whole framework of journalism was like all wrong. I wasn't interested in that, but I was interested in the being there part of it. You know, you're there, and make pictures, things happen. So my first pictures were all of, I would go to political demonstrations and photograph. So all this anti-nuke stuff, that was my first stuff. It was a great adventure. We could sneak in because we looked like protesters, but we'd photograph and could move in and around, and it was kind of amazing. A real high.
Where was that?
It's in New York.
New York?
New York and D.C., yeah.
When you were school or like?
Yeah, when I was school, when I was an undergrad. That's what I was doing.
That sounds crazy.
It's fun. It's fun.
In a good way.
yeah, it was really fun. You would take a 100-foot of black and white film and just roll it up in the canisters and have like 25 rolls on us and just go nuts.
What interested you about that, like specific, because you were political or because it was like a dance when you're photographing something that's happening, or both? Or
both. I mean, it certainly was political. I took, I took grassroots organizing, like classes and nonviolent stuff. My very first thing I ever did, I think it was after my first summer home after going to college, I took these courses and they had just re-initiated draft registration. I think shortly after the Vietnam War, they stopped it. And then at some point in the 80s, they re-engaged it. I put up these posters in my town, in New Jersey, in suburban New Jersey, and saying about protests against draft registration, blah, blah, blah. And I got this call from this woman. She was very excited. She goes, I'd like you to come to our meeting and blah, blah. And it was all these like middle-aged women left over from the Vietnam War. So me and the middle-aged women went and protested at the post office and did a whole kind of sit-in thing, and we got union organizers and all this kind of stuff. And it was me and a bunch of 50-year-old women. It's kind of great. It was kind of great. And so that was my politics. But I also love the activity of it and photographing it for sure.
So then I guess I'm interested in like how you started that shift to setting up photos from that like documentary of political situations.
My father, when he fell from the train, when my father had an accident, and I had just started doing portraits. So I saw, actually came from Rich and Poor. I saw Rich and Poor, Jim Goldberg's book, Rich and Poor. And I liked the handwriting. I liked the fact that the people in the pictures responded, So I did a series of pictures of just anybody that I could make portraits of. So friends, family, whatever, that I could bring a print back and have them write under it. I had no idea how Jim did it, how he worked it. I didn't know him then. And I just naively went about doing it. And so I would make like four prints. And my families are part of this, but I also have friends with a print on top, and a lot of white, and I would just hand them and I'd say, could you write something? And, 90% of the time they wrote something really lame, really stupid. Not stupid, but I don't know what I would write. If you handed that to me, I would also sit there and not be able to write anything, right? I figured all the amazing things in Jim's, in that book just happened spontaneously. I was so naive. But anyway, that's how I started this notion that you could get to the truth by maybe not capturing it, but by asking for it. And if you ask for the truth and you ask the right questions, you can get there. You can find it, It'll come to you maybe. And I was just beginning to think about, I was just beginning to engage in the process with that. And then when my father had an accident, I shifted from using the camera as a way to go outside myself to deal, And I moved back home, and it was awful and hard. And I made pictures to sort of survive, really. And then I ended up going to grad school and continuing. And then with my family, they became more and more directed. They just evolved that way. A lot of it was also trying to learn how to light. And I was so bad at it, I had to direct it, you know, because I made so many mistakes and screwed it up all the time. And they had to be patient, and I couldn't figure out, you know, like even just basic bounce flash.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Because it's all film, so you can't
see it.
You don't see it, right? You just like shoot a lot, and then you just realize you underexpose the whole fucking thing, and that's a drag, you know?
Yeah.
Or you aimed the light wrong or something. So eventually I knew the exposure in each one of my rooms because I would just test it. And then I just knew the kitchen was 5.6 or whatever. And then when the lights got more elaborate, it was just a process, and they were patient.
Mm-hmm.
So after they've been hanging around for an hour, what do you do after they're bored? And they're like, can we get this picture done? You gotta start inventing.
I want to hear more about you... and the idea of truth in photography, like how honest do you think pictures are? Or like, do you think they're the opposite or like, I don't know.
It really depends how you define honesty.
Yeah. I mean,
Well, honesty is that, well, you know, it's tricky with pictures. I mean, it depends. There's two important things. In terms of the honesty of the pictures, there's what's involved as the picture's made. That's a factor. But the really important thing in terms of honesty of picture is how the picture's used. So how do you frame it? And if that framing, that the meanings that you're kind of hoping to generate or you're contextualizing with? Yeah, it just depends what you do with it. So like when I was photographing in Ireland, again, a lot of those pictures are performed and invented and whatever. But the work is completely, I stand by it completely as an honest picture of that place and those people. And I think for the most part, they would agree, and because I worked really hard at making a book that could live in that community, and the fact that the book does live in that community, I think in some ways it verifies the truth of the work.
Here's Jonathan Gardenhire explaining why he chose Leslie Hewitt as his idol.
At first glance, I think it's relatively apparent why I chose Leslie Hewitt as my mentor, considering that I make still life pictures with books. But I have to thank my discovery of her work to Andrew Bordwin. In 2013, after seeing some pictures I had been making for a year or so, he asked if I was familiar with Leslie's work. Unusually, I wasn't, but was immediately drawn to two seminal projects, Riffs on Real Time and Make It Plain, which did so much for me when I experienced them. I was pleasantly full by Leslie's attention to the materiality of objects and photographs, and what I felt was a substantial belief in the elasticity of photography. In that moment where I was trying to figure out how my images exist and interact with both my heroes and contemporaries, Leslie's work helped inspire me to create a blueprint for my own visual language.
The Vice Magazine podcast is a production of Vice Media. This issue was produced and edited by Rob Schulte. For more info on the podcast or how to subscribe to the magazine, visit vice.com, and be sure to subscribe to the Vice Magazine podcast on Apple Podcasts, Acast, or any podcast app you use. And be sure to leave us a rating and review and let us know what you think. I'm Ellis Jones, and I'd like to give a special thanks to all the voices you heard on this episode. Elizabeth Renstrom, Tommy Ka, Tasnima Sultan, Logan Jackson, Ro Etheridge, Maria Grisdeva, Doug Dubois, Olivia B., and Jonathan Gardenhire. We'll be back next month with our September issue.
even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.